This is the PBT Podcast, the most comprehensive and entertaining 30 minutes on the NBA anywhere. From insights to interviews, we've got you covered. Here are your hosts, Pro Basketball Talk's Kurt Helin and Eitan Shander.
We are back. Another edition of the PBT Podcast, the postseason Kevin Durant MVP, Mark Jackson fired edition of the Pro Basketball Talk Podcast alongside Kurt Helin, PBT.NBCSports.com. Eitan Shander with you. And we'll be joined by Roland Lazenby coming up a little bit later in this podcast. He's an author of the new book about Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan, The Life. It's already out there. Bookstores everywhere, Amazon, all the places you can get it. So we'll chat with Roland. Kurt had a chance to sit down and chat with Roland a little bit earlier, so we'll get that interview. But first, the big story this week, and it seems like there's a new off-the-court story every week, Mark Jackson fired, no longer the head coach of the Golden State Warriors, Kurt. And I asked you, before we even started this, how much of this do you think is mutual, that Mark Jackson really is okay with being out?
More than a lot of people think. This wasn't one-sided. He would have stayed and come back because he liked the players. And let's be honest, that team's bordering on, even though they were bounced in the first round, this team is bordering on contending. They're a 51-win team that's not that far off of the elite in the West, and that's a hard situation to give up. I mean, wherever he lands, it's almost certainly not going to be as good. He didn't want to go necessarily in that sense, but this was fairly mutual. He's a great motivator. The players loved him. He ate it up. He's charismatic, but he's also very stubborn, and he wants things done his way, and that can lead to kind of an abrasive quality. And he eventually just lost all friends in management down to the very end. You know, he had a couple supporters in there, and over the course of the last month or two, he lost them, and that was pretty much it. Unless they had such a great run that they couldn't let him go, they're willing to make a change.
Yeah, and it's so crazy, right? Because this isn't the Knicks who are just in utter dismay right now. It's not the Lakers who have that top 10 pick and have some sense of hope, but still they're down. This is a team you mentioned that can contend. They've got some of the best talent, Steph Curry, in there. They did it last year without David Lee. They do it this year without Andrew Bogut. So there's all these things from a basketball sense that stand out, yet when you look at Mark Jackson and the reports that have come out that he has alienated ownership, people above him, below him, everybody that basically is not on his actual basketball team. And then there's also, I think, something that maybe is just how the NBA is moving forward. You can speak to this better than me, which is this sense of you being a former player and especially as a point guard, and Mark Jackson thinking, I know how it was done. I want to do it my way. With the ever-changing evolution of analytics being thrown into this game, is this just the latest casualty of head coach and analytic-minded ownership or maybe general management looking at, and in butting heads?
Yeah, I don't even think it's so much the analytics, although that was certainly a little bit of that here, but it was really a lot more of just the abrasiveness and him not getting along with management. It's personality more than strategy or anything like that. I think, look, this is now four in the last year, since the end of last season up to now, four 50-win coaches that are let go. We'll see how this goes with Golden State. I think this puts tremendous amount of pressure on management to upgrade. I don't think that in Denver they upgraded. I mean, part of that is that the roster took a step back, but I don't know that Brian Shaw was an upgrade. Dave Joerger in Memphis is kind of a wash. They had a worse season, but they were also without Marc Gasol for extended periods, which put them in a brutal first-round matchup with Oklahoma City. That was a better team that would have won a lot more games if he'd been around. The Clippers upgraded. It'll be interesting. I think there's a lot of pressure on management there now to upgrade. And, you know, you hear them wanting to talk to Steve Kerr. I'm like, you know, everybody likes Steve Kerr. I like Steve Kerr. But pulling another guy with absolutely no coaching experience out of the booth and plopping him in just doesn't make as much sense as going and getting. I know they're interested in Stan Van Gundy. That guy, Stan, makes way more sense to me. Going and getting somebody like George Karl makes way more sense to me than pulling Kerr in, with all due respect to Kerr. Right. He, you know, I just don't see that.
Well, it helps when Phil Jackson has an eye on you, right? All of a sudden your stock just increases all the way around. And you put this up there. You guys did a great job on probasketballtalk.nbcsports.com about possible suitors now for this job in Golden State. And one of the things, I guess the thing that jumped out about Stan Van Gundy, and I don't want to paraphrase what you guys were saying there, but it's you just left somebody like Mark Jackson, who is very outspoken and wants to do things his own way. Stan clearly is that guy. Are we now in the position, because you're right, you can't be the Lakers right now, and maybe you can't even be the Knicks, where you can take a shot on a guy who hasn't done this before, regardless if Steve Kerr has front office pedigree. If you're the Warriors, not to say it can't be done, Kurt, but you really have cornered yourself now where you need to bring somebody who is already established as a prior head coach in the NBA. I don't know how you can bring somebody out of college or Norhouse, you know, somebody like Kerr, you said.
Well, I think exactly. I mean, they among the lists down that, you know, that we'd put up and names we heard, there were some, yeah, they want to talk to Tom Thibodeau. I'm sure they do. If
the
Bulls are going to let him go, 29 other teams might like to talk to Tom Thibodeau. The Knicks were reportedly asking around. So that said, I don't think the Bulls will let him go. You know, I think Carl's an interesting fit. D'Antoni fits on paper, but I'm not sure that that back to the A, the abrasive personality issues, and B, they'd have to make a lot of roster changes to fit he's rigid with his system. So I don't see that one going. You mentioned that college doesn't make that much sense. It's like, it's not that, hey, maybe Fred Hoiberg or Kevin Ollie or some of these guys will be really great NBA head coaches someday. But is that the upgrade? Is that the risk you're taking? I think they have to get established. They have to go with a name and somebody they can count on upgrading this roster.
Who is that name, right? Easier said than done to throw a bunch of people up. Hey, Jeff Van Gundy?
I don't know if you can pull Jeff out of the booth. Jeff's pretty happy. You might, but he'd be hard to get out. If I were making the odds right now, I'd put Stan at the top. They want to talk to Kerr, but everybody around the league seems to think Kerr is probably still landing in New York. And there's some logic to that in terms of he needs some time to build what he's going to build and figure out who he is. You walk into you like we said, when you take over this job, you better win tomorrow, you know, with Golden State. There's no learning curve allowed there. Mark Jackson was allowed a learning curve because they were pretty bad, you know. But you're not going to get that. Whoever's next has got to win tomorrow. In New York, they're going to be terrible next year, you know. You can get away with learning a little bit on the job and counting that off as establishing culture and building a winner there. So
you don't have the benefit, I think, especially if you're Steve Kerr, to kind of lean on a guy like Phil Jackson in Golden State. It's kind of like you come in and you don't have any training on the job, right? It's your first day on the job, and everybody just backs off and says, okay, go win us a championship. Now, the roster for Golden State, if we expect people to be coming back, right, healthier. So there is the idea, unlike these other jobs that we've thrown out, that this team is pretty much ready-made to compete. I don't know if they can win a championship next year, but they're ready-made healthy, I would think, to compete with anybody.
They're close. I think they need a few more pieces. They've got to get some more reliable depth, more consistent up front. I mean, nothing. Look, David Lee and Andrew Bogut are great when they're healthy, but you got to, and same with Jermaine O'Neal. But Jermaine O'Neal's a fine backup when healthy, but they've got to get younger, more athletic, and somebody that they can count on more consistently every night up front, not to be injured. They need some depth up there, and there's some other. You know, I think they could strengthen the bench in a few places. They missed Jarrett Jack this year, I think some. But all that said, they're. We're talking about tweaks, not major additions.
Right.
With bringing in Iguodala and having Curry and Thompson back there, it's tweaks, not major changes, to get this roster over the top.
And while they're going to have their hands full, as we mentioned, trying to find the right candidate, the big-name candidate, the experienced candidate, if you will, this, I would think, maybe puts some inadvertent pressure on two guys, Scott Brooks and Frank Vogel. Now you have a bigger pool of guys to throw at, right? And let's say both of these teams lose in this round. And I know that after game one of the Pacers Wizards, right? Both ones, right? Does this not put maybe added pressure on these two guys because the coaching pool that you can pull from has now become bigger with a guy like Mark Jackson? I would think it does.
I think you were right. I think it's going to be interesting Yeah, I think that there's a really – we haven't even mentioned because he's not – I haven't heard his name thrown around in this job, but Lionel Hollins is out there.
Perfect
I mean, there's
name.
Good coaches, very good coaches out there looking for jobs, let alone, you know, some quality assistants and guys coming up. So it's deep right now with good coaches. And you're right. Look, Vogel's a more interesting case. They're going to sit down and talk, and they've got some roster decisions to make on top of that. I think that the – you can certainly blame some of this on Vogel if you want and his sticking with this system, but when it didn't work last time. But you know what's happened to Roy Hibbert is not all on Vogel. That's on Roy Hibbert at this point. He's wherever he's gone on his mental walkabout.
He's not coming back. You know, he's long gone.
That's not all on Vogel. Brooks, though, there's tension there. There's some – that seat's getting warm in the sense that he got a bye – you know, he got the pass last year with Westbrook out. But there have been questions about his X's and O's and if he could lift this team up for a while. He developed them to a certain point. The players like him, but there's real questions from management and around the league if he's the guy – he's a good coach, but can he get them over the hump? Can he get them to the next level? If not, that's another job – that a lot of coaches would line up for, because you've got Kevin Durant. He's pretty good. And you've got Russell Westbrook. You've got some, you know, Serge Ibaka. There's some really good pieces there. A slightly more complex offensive system that would, you know, some off the ball movement and one other scoring piece. And suddenly that's, you know, this is another team you'd were stepping right into a contender.
And
there'd be a line of guys up for that, you know, a line around the block. And it's an interesting spot for somebody like, you know, it's an interesting for somebody like Stan, who seems to more interested in getting back. He seemed to want a break. Now he kind of seems, at least the way I read, listen to the interviews I've heard with him, he seems more interested. You have him on all the time. He seems to have that itch a little. I don't know if that's, I'm just reading into that or not. But he's got, if he does have that itch to come back, there are really good landing spots available.
Yeah, I agree. I get that too. And he's very diplomatic. And he won't give in, and he won't criticize a coach. He's very hesitant to criticize an active coach out there. You know he won't talk about a position if there's rumors about the guy being gone until there's actually an opening. But with all of the discussion and as passionate as he gets about things, breaking stuff down, I agree that it's difficult for me to not believe that that itch has grown significantly with a guy like Stan. And that goes back to maybe the opening hasn't been right with either Scotty Brooks now or Frank Vogel, those two spots, Golden State as well. Who was the – I mean, I can't even remember. Has there ever been a head coach fired the same year that he coached the MVP?
Well, I wouldn't – wow, that's kind of a crazy thought. I would imagine not. I would imagine –
could you – I mean, could that could be a reality for Scotty Brooks.
Yeah, it's a – you know, it'd be interesting to see where he lands too, because I think Vogel – if Vogel were let go, he'd get a shot somewhere. And a lot of those teams that are trying to develop a culture would look at how he helped develop that culture in Indiana and jump on it. If you're – you know, he brings a system and a style of play. I'm not sure – Brooks carries the heft around the league, the intellectual heft. I don't know if he'd get a job as quickly. Jackson's going to be interesting too. I think he's going to land somewhere. Those guys played hard for him. Mm-hmm. He showed he's an NBA coach, you know, over these 3 years. I think it's got to be the right front office fit for him. And he's not going to be able to do. Remember, the other thing here is he did this. I don't want to say part time, but he kept his home and his church in L.A. and was there, if not every weekend and every Sunday, virtually everyone he could get there. And wasn't, you know, he had assistants running practices some days so he could go be a minister. And that was part of the agreed on deal when he got there. That's not going to be the agreed on deal wherever he lands next.
No, I can't see that commute happening with Indy, for example.
Exactly. On top of that, it's just as much as he might personality wise fit better on somewhere like Indiana. You're not going to be able to have the way that job was set up in this case.
All right, a couple minutes from now, Roland Lazenby, author of the new book, Michael Jordan, The Life. Kurt Elin had a chance to sit down and chat with Roland, but we are one game in for each of the four series now, East and West, and they've all been snoozers, let's be honest.
Yeah, I'm actually jonesing for close games again.
All right, so let's look at it this, right, because we've got Roland coming up. Which of the four is most likely to be a sweep? Which of the four is most likely to go seven?
I still think the Oklahoma City Clippers won, as much as that was a blowout in game one. And the Clippers really exposed something. Their defense was much better. Their ball movement was much better. I still think that is a series that goes seven. I still think that those, at least six. I mean, those two teams are still evenly matched. And I think KD is going to come out in the next game. They'll make their defensive adjustments. Chris Paul's not going to shoot like that. It's going to be a much closer game too. I still think that series goes deep. I'll tell you what, if the Spurs keep playing like that, I don't know that might be a sweep. It's not that the Blazers are a bad team. I mean, they had a really sound defensive strategy, and they've done this for a couple games now. They did this in the regular season. They put Splitter on LaMarcus Aldridge, and they say, all right, Blazers, throw it to him. We're going to single cover your best player. Let him put up points. Nobody else is going to get away. Nobody else is going to get free. And that's exactly what happened. Aldridge had 32 points. The rest of the team shot 33%. They were 4 of 16 from 3. They weren't getting easy buckets. And it was kind of the old, you used to see this with, speaking of Jordan's Bulls, you saw this with Jordan's Bulls. There was a period of time where we're like, we're going to let Jordan get his and make sure he doesn't start setting up other guys. If Jordan scores 50, but everybody else scores 40, we got a chance. And right. I think that's kind of almost the strategy the Spurs have used, and they looked really good. So I think that series could go. And by the way, Indiana, I got no idea.
No.
Honestly, I have no idea what team will show up next week. I know that the Wizards are confident and playing well. We might see a really good Indiana team in game two, and then they go back to being terrible in game three. I find them impossible to predict at this point.
Which is amazing, because we'll probably have a seven-game series here with, as you said, Indy looking so good in their wins and looking so awful in their losses that we'll just be sitting there with bated breath on that game seven, not knowing who's going to show up. And again, he very well could see the Wizards moving on as well.
I think the Wizards will move on. We predict... the guy who did our preview at PBT, Dan Feldman, predicted... Dan did that one, and he said Wizards in seven. I think six. I mean, I watching that first game, maybe even less. I mean, yeah. They owned them in that game.
I'll say this real quick. I don't know if it'll be a sweep per se, but if Deron Williams continues to be banged up and his health continues to be an issue here, especially with that position, you need it to be so good and really so impactful against, of all teams, the Miami Heat. Despite Joe Johnson, despite Paul Pierce, and the coaching now that they're getting from Kevin Garnett on the sidelines, on the bench, I don't know, man. This thing could be over fast.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I kind of thought this series would go this way a little bit. I know that there were a lot of people, they beat them four times in the regular season. But you know what? Wade didn't play in two of those. KG didn't play in two of those. The starting lineup that the Nets throw out right now actually played 0 minutes against the Heat.
Wow.
They're just not the same teams. And I watched that game, I watched Nets Raptors game seven, and that was thrilling and fun. And, that was such a fun, entertaining series. And as soon as you watch the Western Conference playoff game after it, you're like, wow, it's not even the same level of play. Like the West is... There are teams in the West so much better than everybody but Miami out East, and Miami is the only team that the level drop-off is insane, and I don't think I think the rest of the series, the Nets will steal one or two, but the games are going to look like this. The game where they hang around for a while, and then the Heat just go, we have this other gear, by the way. You want to see it? And, they shift up one and it's over.
Good luck. Exactly right. All right. Well, hopefully these things get better. These four series get better. And the next time you and I sit down and talk, we'll have some close games to talk about moving forward. But you did have a chance to speak with Roland Lazenby, author of a new book about Michael Jordan. It's called Michael Jordan, The Life. Here's Kurt's chat with Roland.
We are really fortunate to have on the PBT podcast today one of the best authors covering sports in general and the NBA in particular, one of the great writers. His Jerry West book is phenomenal, which you need to go get. But he's got a new book out. Roland Lazenby has a book on Michael Jordan called Michael Jordan, The Life, that dropped on Tuesday. And he's fortunate. We're fortunate. He's going to join us for a couple minutes and talk about the book. Thanks for doing this, Roland.
Oh, happy to do it, Kurt. Always good to talk to you.
So I think when I think of Jordan, and I think a lot of people think of Jordan, the first thing that comes to mind is that ultra competitiveness that he had. And you talk a lot about that in the book, but you seem to circle around to like trying to find out where that come from and what inspired that. Did you ever really figure that out?
Well, you know, I think I did, as much as you could figure out a complex guy like Jordan. But I actually went back and started with the birth of his great-grandfather in 1891. His great-grandfather was 5'5 and crippled, but a really bad guy. Jordan was descended from a bunch of hardcore moonshiners on the coastal plain in North Carolina. And they were, they were tough customers. They had a hard life, but liquor, corn liquor was their cash crop.
And out of that comes a lineage of toughness, I would imagine, then? A guy who a family that kind of had this attitude towards the world?
Uh-oh. Yeah, you know, his great-grandfather, who died when Michael was 14, ruled over the whole family. And his great-grandfather's name was Dawson Jordan, was the original Jordan Tongue. And Michael's father, James, idolized this old man and picked up the tongue from him. And, of course, Michael picked it up from his old man and from his great-grandfather.
Oh, that's kind of crazy to learn. That's funny. What else? What surprised you looking back at his upbringing?
I think his parents were the original helicopter parents. They were the kind of parents, and this was back in the 70s, before people did a lot of this. But they were at every practice. They were everywhere. They were making sure their son was involved. Baseball was a largely white sport, and yet they were very much involved and cared deeply, yet they were never the kind of people to say something to the coach or to complain about something, but they were just involved all the time.
And that's interesting. You mentioned the baseball thing, because ultimately, I think you get into this in the book, when he goes back to baseball, and you know, rumors flew around about why, it ultimately came back to his dad, didn't it?
Oh, it very much did. Michael, you know, before he did not make the varsity in basketball, he was the state Little League Player of the Year in North Carolina. He almost took him to the Little League World Series as a pitcher and a hitter. He was a fabulous, fabulous player as a 12-year-old. And the next 3 years of Babe Ruth League, particularly the next year, he hardly got off the bench. He batted four times the whole season. The base paths had lengthened, and he didn't have the arm to play. And Jordan's, you know, youth sports could be cruel like that. They were very cruel to Jordan. In Babe Ruth League for 3 years, he never made a single All-Star team. And he was the Player of the Year for the entire state as a 12-year-old. So that was a major crash for him.
Is that when he starts to focus more on basketball, or were they always kind of simultaneous?
No, basketball started to become a focus about then. They got involved. I interviewed the guys who coached them, and the guys were involved. Michael was this little gunner. He and his brother looked like twins. His brother was 11 months older, and they battled. The father put up a hoop in the backyard, then put up two, you know, facing hoops in the backyard of their house right outside of Wilmington. And they battled, you know, the battles he had with his brother, and his brother beat him every single day for about a year and a half. And then finally, Michael was taller, but his older brother was a lot stronger. But these were not fun battles. And as George Mumford, you know, the great psychologist who worked with Phil Jackson at the Lakers, well, before that, he worked with Phil Jackson at the Bulls. And he said that Michael related to his teammates the same way he related to his brother in childhood. He just battled his teammates. And it was always about dominating them. James Worthy was a junior at North Carolina when Michael came in as a freshman. And in the interviews for this book, Worthy told me, Michael was a bully, and he bullied me. And Michael, the other part of this, he just was really hard in how he dealt with his teammates. He was a bully.
And that had, I mean, it's funny because we look back on that now, and it's because of the championships, frankly, and because of the winning, it's kind of idolized in a way it probably shouldn't be, frankly.
Yes and no. Michael was fully accountable. He laid his heart on the line every single night. Jerry Krause, who loathes Michael, in his interviews for the book, he was always pointing out this and that, but when you hear Krause start talking about Michael the player and how much he cared and how hard he played, you know if there was anything negative that Jerry could say about him, he would say it. But he said, I have no complaints with how he played for the Bulls. Now, off the court, he was very tough to deal with, but he cared more than anybody ever could have.
And some people on that team certainly rallied around him. I mean, they became a tight group with him and Horace Grant and some of the guys he was tight with on that Bulls team.
Right. He could be really tough on Horace Grant. And they had their share of conflict. And he was brutal on Pippen. But that's what toughened Pippen up as a young player. And they would have just fierce battles. They'll like to pit them against each other like two pit bulls in practice. And practices, as Krause and others said, the practices were far more entertaining than the games. And Michael was just fierce all over Pippen. And, you know, making him become tougher and to grow up.
Well, talk about Phil Jackson's influence through all this. And was he just the right guy at the right time, or what did he bring to the table that helped evolve the Bulls and Jordan?
Well, Phil Jackson, first of all, was there first as an assistant coach. And that meant that he could study Michael, and he looked at all the problems the Bulls were having. And also, once he became head coach, Phil had Tex Winter and the great Johnny Bock, these two elderly, very accomplished assistant coaches, as his mentor. And Phil built this perfect relationship with Jordan. Tex Winter told me time and again, it was unbelievable how Phil built this relationship with Jordan. And the team was then built from that relationship.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting that he was able to bridge that gap where certainly other coaches were not able to. Was this just, I mean, I guess Phil has that gift. He's had it with the Lakers. He's had it kind of everywhere he's been.
Right. At the Lakers, he built that kind of, it wasn't the depth of relationship with Shaquille O'Neal that he had with Jordan. With Jordan, it really was a very different relationship. But as you well know about Phil Jackson, Kurt, he is a supremely competitive guy.
Yes.
And so it was the matching of his competitive will with Jordan's that really created the powerful dynamic for that team. Two very strong personalities in agreement there, in unison.
The other thing that was amazing about the Jordan competitive streak that you talk about in the book is that not only was everything fueled for it, it didn't even have to be real. It was every slight perceived and some imagined.
Right. The thing that George Mumford found, the psychologist, in working with Michael, is that most people want to be in the zone, but they can't get there. But Jordan could access it on a regular basis. And he had all these devices for pushing his psyche into the zone of really high levels of performance. And if he didn't have something to get him there, he would just make up things to get himself going. And then he would take umbrage at things he had made up. But it didn't matter as long as it got him into that state of high performance.
That competitiveness did carry over into his gambling as well, didn't it? I mean, that's obviously, when people talk about the off-the-court stuff sometimes with him, that's one of the first, or at least the most salacious things that came up. But the league obviously never gave him trouble about that, or publicly anyway.
Well, you know, there are a lot of conspiracy theories that Michael was suspended for gambling. But one of the things that is clear is that no one at any time ever had the slightest allegation that Michael Jordan bet on basketball or bet on his own team. Michael's gambling was either in a casino or on the golf course or at playing a card game at his house in Hilton Head. But what you do know is that Michael Jordan, if they had suspended him for that kind of gambling, I'm not sure they could have an NBA, because the NBA is filled with people who gamble. And Charles Barkley today is the face of the NBA. He's an unrepentant gambler. And, you know, if Michael had, Michael's always said, I'm no Pete Rose. I've never gambled on the game. If he had, David Stern wouldn't work as hard as he did to make Michael the owner in Charlotte. David Stern really went out of his way to make him an owner there. And you don't do that for guys if they dishonor the game with some kind of illegal gambling. As much as Jerry Krause despises Michael Jordan, Krause says, no way. There was no way he ever let anything get in the way of his competing. And he was all there, all business, all the time. And anyone who tries to insinuate that is either trolling for hits or they haven't looked at the facts. No one has ever said, Michael did this or Michael did that. It's all about the kind of gambling he did that everyone knows about.
And you mentioned him getting put in as an owner. You actually, I think, call it the second act of his career. How is he adapting to that? Is he adjusting and to, is he able to fuel some of that competitiveness that way?
He is. You know, when Michael went and played baseball after his father was murdered, a lot of people really lampooned him, made fun of him, said all these things. Sports Illustrated attacked him. But a few years afterward, people started looking back and looking at what he did to change sports like that, and all of the effort and, you know, this lack of fear about embarrassing himself, just wanting to honor baseball by working as hard as he could. And he made real progress in baseball, although it took a while for it to happen. But people started to look back and say, you know, Michael did an exceptional thing playing baseball. So then when he leaves basketball for good and goes to Washington and he tries to please Abe Pollin and he plays and he makes $50 million for the team, but Abe Pollin fires him afterward and Michael is lampooned for the Kwame Brown draft, and then he goes to Charlotte and, you know, some of his draft picks and his decisions are called into question. But as time goes on, everybody looks back at Michael the owner or Michael the executive, and they see that his learning curve and his work ethic is much more than they realized. And he has gone into Charlotte, which is the Chernobyl of the NBA. The old Hornets with George Shinn trashed the place. Yeah. Then the rollout of the Bobcats. It was a horrible rollout. And Charlotte was a horrible market. I'm sure, Kurt, you saw some of those crowds during the first round with Charlotte playing Miami. That place was packed again. It's like the old Hornets. And the longer people look at Michael Jordan as an owner, they're going to come to realize that the guy is there and he's doing a lot better. He's making something happen. Hey, people have underestimated him again. And the simple truth of it is, Michael was so great as a player, there was just no way. The expectations were so high that he couldn't do the kinds of magical things as an executive and an owner that he did as a player. And people were angry about that.
Was part of what he had to learn letting go and, you know, bringing in guys like Rich Cho and stuff and letting them have some power over this as opposed to his decisions?
Yes. And part of that is what a good owner does. We're all waiting for Jim Buss to do it in Los Angeles, to learn that you really have to have people make those decisions. It's not about your ego. An owner, and Dr. Jerry Buss knew that. An owner, there are times you speak up, and yes, you drive the agenda with your will to win, but you've got to hire the good basketball people and let them work for you. And if Michael Jordan has to do that, then Jim Buss certainly should. I hate to get that dig in about the Lakers. But
you can never do enough digs about the Lakers.
Yeah, it's a comparable thing, I believe. And, I don't think it's any shame on Jim Buss, but I think it's a tough lesson he's going to have to learn. But I do think those Buss kids, when they learn their lessons, will end up making the old man proud. Just as I think Jordan has taken some tough, tough knocks as an owner and executive, but yet he's learned from those things.
And he's learning on things even like the Donald Sterling thing, where he kind of doesn't say anything at first, but then within 24 hours, he's one of the first owners out with a pretty strong statement against Sterling.
Right, and one of the things I point out in the book, people got all over Michael when he was a young player for not speaking out politically. But one thing people don't realize, it's a big part of this book, North Carolina had more Klan members than all the other southern states combined. And African Americans in North Carolina were violently barred from politics. And the Jordan family, and particularly his mother's family, they were sharecroppers, and they focused their whole lives on trying to make economic gains. And his mother's father actually did something nobody did. He made money as a sharecropper. But my point in all this is Michael Jordan didn't come from the kind of culture where people felt comfortable getting involved in politics. That was a quick way to real trouble. And so once he got a little older, he was ready to do his share. But boy, people were all over him as a young player. You know, he didn't do himself any favors by saying Republicans buy shoes too. But in a perverse way, that did help Michael as a businessman because he did not politicize his business.
Very true. Well, thank you. The book is a fascinating read. You've got to pick it up. It's everywhere. You can go. You can order it from Amazon. Better yet, go to Powell's.com and order it there, or go to your independent bookstore and pick it up. It'll be everywhere starting on the Tuesday. Thanks again, Roland, for dropping in.
Kurt, you're the man.
Thanks again to Roland Lazenby. The book is Michael Jordan, The Life. For Kurt Heelan, Eitan Shander, it is the PBT Podcast. We'll chat next week.